the Market, sponsored by the CME Group. Dateline Chicago, Friday, February 24th. What a day on Wall Street. The worst day in 10 months. Bank shares down for the largest drop in nearly 5 years. And the S&P 500 ended in negative territory for the year to date. And what caused it all? Well, the surprise from the United Kingdom, Great Britain, as a result of the vote that I think going into the vote, a lot of people were expecting that they would vote to remain in the European Union. And so the shock today really rattled world markets and rattled Wall Street and banks, particularly oil, all of it down. Let's look at just some of the highlights. The British pound touched a 30-year low versus the U.S. dollar. Stocks dropped sharply across the globe on fears the decision could hurt investment and usher in many months of both political and economic uncertainty. Equity futures neared an 11-month high to start the overnight session, as markets wrongly were betting the Remain camp would prevail in the referendum. And when the actual results came out, stock markets sold off sharply, triggering a market stop put in place to curtail volatility. The decline during regular market hours seemed more orderly, but the S&P 500 financial sector posted its largest percentage decline since November of 2011, tumbling 5.4%. The S&P 500 lost all of the year's gains and suffered its largest decline since late August of last year. The S&P managed to close in the area of what analysts called significant technical support near 2040, but many traders expect the next few weeks to remain volatile. And what about the volatility index at the CBOE, the Chicago Board Options Exchange? We call it VIX. I translate it to the worry factor. Up 49% today, taking it to 25.76. That is its highest level since February 11, when equities hit their lows of the year. So, what several people are saying today, what I see going to happen is the Federal Reserve will not raise rates in 2016. That is off the table, and the market positive, said one analyst. He went on to say, if you have cash on the sidelines, it could be a buying opportunity, but I wouldn't be changing bonds or stocks allocations right now, because he said he expects other major central banks to also give the market support. What about trading volume today on the U.S. markets? 15.2 billion. As the trade-heavy reconstitution of the Russell indexes crossed at the market close, it was the highest trading volume since August of 2011. And again, the number was 15.2 billion. Compare that with the 20 trading session daily average of 6.8 billion shares traded daily over the past 20 years. So, looking more closely at the bank situation and what this has done to the banks as a result of the surprising vote, the sterling hit a 31-year low. The slide in stocks wiped out about $726 billion from the market value of Europe's listed shares. The pan-European stocks, Europe 600 index, fell 7%. To 321.9 points, its biggest one-day decline since 2008. And while the FTSE Euro First 300 slid 6.6%. So Britain's shock decision raised concerns over the growth outlook for Britain and Europe, reawakened concerns of political instability on the continent, some investors pointing to Italy as the next country to watch, while Spain is due to hold a general election on Sunday. And there is concern that it could be the start of the breakup of the European Union. And then there are concerns for the integrity of the United Kingdom itself, with leaders in Scotland, where nearly two-thirds of voters wanted to stay in the EU, calling for a new independence referendum. So that's what you're looking at, and it'll take a day or two to shake it out. But this is strictly my opinion, having watched market declines over the last 50 years or so. Markets, when they take this kind of a huge drop, in a day or two, I think savvy traders will start looking at some of the stock prices as a result of the decline and say, that's a pretty good bargain right now in the stock market. Let's go and buy. And the world is not going to come to an end because Britain moved out of the European Union. But no question today, a lot of people thought it was coming to an end, but I still think next week we are going to be looking at a higher market eventually. It may take 2 or 3 days, and that is just a thought from someone who is not a market analyst, really. The oil market down 5% because of the vote. And the dollar index jumped about 2%. That's its most since 2008. But looking at the oil market, Brent crude settled down 4.9%, down $2.50 a barrel at $48.41. U.S. crude oil fell 5%, or $2.47, to settle at $47.64. That's its largest one-day decline since February. And the losses really were much smaller on the week for oil. Brent crude ended the week down 1.5%. U.S. crude ended the week down 0.7%. So that's a look at what happened with the Brexit thing, as it's been called. Now we'll watch next week. And then keep in mind, next week, we will be trading the regular trading hours, but when we come to the end of next week, we're going into a three-day holiday weekend, and that will probably affect a great deal the buying and investing decisions made by investors, not really anxious to take a big plunge going into a three-day holiday weekend next week. So Brexit is over. The surprise isn't, but how long will the surprise last remains to be seen. The commodity markets, well, like all of the markets, they traded lower today for the most part, and we're about to listen in on a conversation that Max Armstrong recorded Thursday before the Brexit vote with Brian Basting, a market analyst with Advanced Trading in Bloomington, Illinois. And when you listen to the visit, keep in mind that it was recorded before the shock of Brexit. So stay with us for that and more when we continue on the markets, sponsored by the CME Group.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need, today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
Rains came this week to some of the biggest grain-producing counties of Illinois and Indiana. We're sitting down to talk about it with Brian Basting, Advanced Trading, Bloomington, Illinois. It occurred to me that, yeah, when you take a look at LaSalle County, Illinois, and Iroquois County, Illinois, and Newton County, Indiana, Montgomery County, Indiana, White County, those typically rank in the top 10 counties in corn and soybean production of the two states. It did help, did it not?
Those areas had been dry, Max. Most of the good rains up until this point had been in the northern Corn Belt, and you stretch that even westward into parts of Iowa, Minnesota. Those the areas had gotten good rains. The areas that had been dry, as you said, included central Illinois, west central Indiana, Parts of Michigan are still dry. They didn't catch those rains this week. So it's a welcome rain. I think some of these areas would even welcome a bit more.
We took some of the rain premium out of the market, did we not? Some of the weather premium?
Quite a bit. I think that from last Friday's close, that would be about a 10% drop in December new crop corn futures. Almost 45 cents from that high close on Friday to Wednesday's close. So the market really had a weather premium in there. Part of that was probably speculative buying.
A farmer in Tippecanoe County, Indiana, said he needs another one in about 2 weeks. He says he's a couple of weeks away from pollination of the corn crop there, not far from Lafayette. So I would imagine the market will continue to watch, and especially some trouble spots. There are still some, are there not, in the Corn Belt where they have not picked up rain?
There are. I think that particularly, as you said, with pollination just around the corner now, the moisture needs really increase, and it can really dry out quickly, even after a rain. So the other thing that everyone's watching now is the high pressure ridge that's centered over that western U.S. And it's anchored there for now. But if that were to migrate back east during pollination, that would be bad news. But fortunately for now, it seems to have moved west and really cooled things down.
Southern Illinois area, southern Indiana, down into the Boot Heel of Missouri, I've heard from growers in recent days. The pendulum really swung there. They had been wet early, and then they turned off dry. Are they still?
Well, it's scattered, I think is the best word I'd use. Parts of Missouri are dry, more the western areas of Missouri. Some of the areas of central Illinois, southern Illinois, did miss those rains this week, at least the heavy rains. And at this point, that's good for the wheat harvest, but the corn and beans, I think, would certainly need a drink at some point here. Probably southern Indiana, southern Illinois, corn pollination is creeping up very quickly, probably around the 4th of July.
We're just days ahead of major government reports as we get an update on these crops. The acreage report will be big, won't it?
It will be. I think there seems to be an underlying belief that we're going to see more soybean acres. We'll see. We'll see what they do with the corn acres, because there were some questions on the March report that total acreage in the March report was low. So the bias is where we're going to see a contraction in corn acreage in next week's report. That's certainly possible. I would caution your listeners, though, that the missing acres, if you will, from that March report could very well still show up in this report. So at this point, I think that the bias of the market is more soybean acres, unchanged to lower corn.
When that report comes out, how quickly will it fade and the attention again to be turned toward weather?
Very important, because I think it will immediately turn back to the weather, because we've got a three-day weekend coming up shortly after that. The report comes out on Thursday, June 30th, but we'll trade that rest of the day and then on Friday. But then July 4th is a Monday, so there'll be a three-day weekend. There will be no trading. And then a critical two-week span of corn pollination. So there's no question that we'll immediately turn back to what the weather looks like going into that early pollination.
Let's continue our discussion about weather for just a moment. Let us make an assumption here that we continue to pick up some rains over the Corn Belt and that the corn crop goes into that pollination period just fine. Do we still have lingering weather worries about how the soybean crop gets finished up?
I think that the soybean crop, as your listeners know, Max, really is contingent on what happens in August. I think we can't get ahead of ourselves. So I think with the demand worldwide so strong and the South American supply is tighter than what we anticipated earlier this spring, there's a great deal of attention on this pod set, pod fill period for this 2016 bean crop.
You alluded to it a little bit earlier, the speculative element in the markets. What's been going on with those folks here the past few days? Obviously, the Brexit vote has drawn quite a bit of attention.
You know, I think that I have not sensed that there's panic liquidation. We'll take a look at the Commitment of Traders report and see. But I've sensed that there's at least a hesitancy to buy more, even on the pullback. We'll see. But I think that I haven't sensed that it's a full-scale run for the door liquidation phase that we're in yet. But I do think that they've pulled back in terms of that aggressive buying phase that they were in.
The resiliency of the soybean market has been remarkable. I mean, it has been beaten back some, but we've never really seen a precipitous fall to a great extent, have we?
We need a large soybean crop. I think that the smaller crops that were harvested in Brazil and Argentina really emphasized how tight the world supplies are relative to demand. Now, we're not running out of old crop beans here in the U.S. We're going to have a 300, 325, maybe 350 carryout, but the demand is so strong, we need a large crop, and now that door is closed for South America, we need to have a good crop here in the U.S.
Brian, thank you for coming in. Always, it's good to talk to you, and we'll look forward to the next opportunity.
Appreciate the opportunity, Max. Always good to be with you.
Max Armstrong with Brian Basting of the Advanced Trading Group in Bloomington, Illinois. Any of you remember what was going on in agriculture a year ago? Well, here's a reminder. Bird flu. That's right. That was the main topic of conversation a year ago at this time. And recently I had a sit-down interview with Dr. Jerry Dick, who is the Associate Administrator of APHIS at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and he talked about last year's outbreak.
The 2015 outbreak actually started in December of 2014, but we refer to it as the 2015 outbreak, was the largest animal disease outbreak in U.S. history. It affected 21 states, but Minnesota and Iowa were especially hard hit. We depopulated almost 50 million birds in those states as part of our eradication effort and spent nearly $1 billion on response, cleanup, and indemnity costs. That doesn't include the lost exports, the temporary shortages, or price increases for certain poultry, and certainly doesn't take in all of the losses that the producers had as a result of that outbreak. This year, we planned for the worst, but so far, we've only had an isolated outbreak in Indiana, to which we're thankful for, in DuBois County, Indiana. A single commercial turkey flock was infected with high-path avian influenza, and nearby, we had 9 flocks that had low-path avian influenza that we also took as part of our response. While high-path causes mortality in affected flocks, birds with low-path often don't show any signs of infection or show very minor signs of infection, and there comes the rub. H7 and H5 hemagglutinin types or strains of low-path have the ability to mutate. And one of our worst fears is that those normally circulating viruses in wild birds, shorebirds, will get into our commercial poultry flocks or backyard flocks or live bird markets and begin to circulating within those commercial markets and then mutate into a high-path virus. Because of that concern, we generally respond very quickly to low-path H5 and H7 viruses because we don't want them to stay in those populations. And so we worked very closely with the state of Indiana in this case to remove both the low-path flocks in the neighborhood and that one high-path flock. It's worth noting that the isolated outbreak in Indiana that we dealt with in January was caused by a North American strain of avian influenza. While our 2015 outbreak was unique because it was caused by a Eurasian strain of the virus that had not previously been seen in the United States. But regardless of the lineage of the virus, and I don't want to delve too much into the weeds here, the technicalities, high-path avian influenza or the influenza viruses in general survive well in cold, wet weather. So as temperatures rise in the spring and we move into summer across the United States, the likelihood of another outbreak decreases because of that warm weather and things drying out. And so that's positive.
Dr. Jerry Dick said they learned some things from a year ago, and so far they feel fortunate there has not been a major outbreak this year.
Although we've been fortunate to avoid a repeat of 2015, we really must continue to be vigilant when it comes to HPAI. And so we in APHIS have been actively conducting wild bird surveillance across the United States. Since July of last year until now, we have already met our target of 40,000 wild birds sampled statistically across the United States, and we will continue to do that wild bird sampling. The way that helps us is that if we get a sense of the virus that's actually circulating in the wild bird population, then we know what areas those birds are detected in, and we can take proactive steps to notify producers that we have detected certain viruses within their state.
Dr. Jerry Dick, who is the Associate Administrator of APHIS at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Back with more when we continue on The Market, sponsored by the CME Group.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
As we look at commodity markets for the week, they reacted today to the Brexit thing in the European Union, but they also reacted to weather this week as rains came. And as I commented a week ago, second week of June is really early for a weather market to take place. And indeed, when the rains fell and the weather improved this week, we saw the big decline that pulled corn prices below $4 in the nearby contract. And corn and soybeans ended the day lower today because of the commodity sell-off. Wheat was mixed with the front month Chicago Board of Trade soft red winter wheat contract, managing a small gain. One trader in the ag community said, make no mistake about it, Brexit was a huge change in the macro market. It's going to change a lot of hedge fund ideas about the dollar and how to position themselves in commodities. And so at the end of the week, this is what happened, and this is where we'll start Monday in the grain market. July wheat ended with a gain of 0.75 cents today. We'll start trading Monday at $4.54¾. July corn down another 2 cents a bushel today, so we'll start Monday 3.84½. And July soybeans were hit the hardest, down 15¼ cents. So we'll start the week Monday at $11.03 a bushel in soybeans. Still holding above the $11 mark, but barely. Now, today, the cattle on feed report. Well, some called it neutral, some called it bearish, but for those of you that like to grill steaks and hamburgers, you could be paying a lower price this summer because cattle placed in feedlots jumped 10% in May. However, analysts polled by Reuters had predicted that increase in placements, coupled with steep losses in cattle futures tied to turmoil surrounding Britain's referendum to leave the European Union. Some are saying the data will likely have minimal effect on futures when they reopen on Monday. Rich Feltus, analyst at Brokerage Allendale, or Rich Nelson, analyst at Brokerage Allendale, said, we have to assume that this is already priced in. But in its monthly cattle on feed report today, there were 1,884,000 head of cattle placed in feedlots last week. That's up from 1,719,000 in the same month a year ago. But analysts had predicted placements would go up by 9.2%. Cattle in feedlots as of June 1st totaled 10,780,000 head, and that is up 1% from last year. roughly in line with analyst estimates. And the marketing of cattle came in at 1,794,000, and that was up 5% from a week ago, or I should say from a year ago. So anyway, more beef coming on the market, and the futures markets certainly showed it again today. It's been a tough time for the cattle market. And so today, the August live cattle contract ended at $110.85 a hundredweight, down $3. The August feeder cattle contract down $2.72, so we'll start trading Monday at $139.65. And the lean hog contracts for the month of October will start Monday at $71.60 after losing 60 cents in today's trade. Been a tough go for cattle people, and talked to several of them on ranches in the West, and they're not quite sure what is going to happen. Now, let's take a look at an event that did happen this week that could be very positive. Apparently, Senator Roberts, the Republican chair of the Senate Ag Committee, and Debbie Stabenow, the ranking Democrat on that committee, apparently reached an agreement. And it prompted the National Corn Growers Association to say the introduction of a solution for the Food Labeling Act comes at a critical time when Congress must act to restore sanity to America's food labeling laws. That's the word of Chip Bowling, a Maryland farmer who is president of the National Corn Growers Association. But the two senators announced that an agreement will address the growing threat of what could be a patchwork of state labeling laws. And the National Corn Growers strongly urge the Senate and the House to both act as swiftly as possible to pass the important legislation. And there is a reason for that. Next Friday, the 1st of July, Vermont's mandatory law requiring on-package labels of foods containing ingredients that have been genetically modified will take effect. And if Congress doesn't act right now, families, farmers, and food companies will face chaos in the market and will face higher costs, because multiple studies have shown that the associated costs with Vermont's GMO labeling law and the subsequent patchwork of state laws would cost American families hundreds of dollars more in groceries each year. So we thought we had an agreement at the end of April. We didn't, but hopefully now we do have an agreement that can come through the House and the Senate, get to the president's desk to stave off the Vermont deadline of July 1st. Well, it's been quite a day, quite a week, but that's our time for now, and we'll wait for next week to see what happens. Along with Max Armstrong, I'm Orion Samuelson on The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group.